Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for December 10th, 2023. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, good to have y'all both on the show tonight. And about 20 minutes from now, we're going to have on the show for the second time from Nevada, Alex Diaz. But in addition to Nevada politics, Alex is going to discuss some Mexico politics with us, including their upcoming elections, because I don't know about y'all, but I feel like I should know way more about how Mexican elections work, given that they're our neighbor to the south, compared to what I know about, say, Canadian elections or even British elections across the ocean. So I'm excited about learning tonight. But until then, we're going to talk about some topics. And right off the bat, Kevin McCarthy, somebody we have talked about many times, and it sounds like that our time discussing Kevin McCarthy is likely coming to a close. He announced this past week that he is going to resign from Congress. I guess it's essentially at the end of the year. He'll not make it into 2024 unless I have my dates wrong. As a member of Congress, that's going to trigger a special election in California. It's the Bakersfield area, and I think I read online that it is the most Republican congressional district in California, so it's probably not that great a pickup opportunity, although there is a House seat in Florida that moved somewhere in the neighborhood of like 16 points more Democratic, and if that district were to move in those same numbers, it would actually be, you know, kind of in that margin of error, if you will. So interesting thoughts there. So let's just start off. Catherine, Kevin McCarthy, we won't have him to, in the words, to paraphrase Richard Nixon, kick around anymore. How surprised were you on his resignation?
Not surprised at all. I think he's, you know, he's lost all his influence. And, yeah, I mean, totally understandable on his side. You know, I think it's the only move he had, really.
Yeah, it definitely for somebody that was a climber, which he seemed to be. Kevin McCarthy, you know, we've talked about this for a while, if he'd run again, but I kind of felt like this was a bit of a surprise. What about you?
Yeah, and he called his conference flat-footed, too. They expected him to leave probably at the end of this term, but not at the end of this year. And the way he did it, he announced it in an article he wrote in the Wall Street Journal. And what is happening with Santos gone too, McCarthy leaving at the end of the year, that gets the Republicans down to 220 members, which means they can now only lose three members in any vote, or they can't pass anything. And so the GOP majority is getting pretty precarious, David. It really is, and members are quitting at a record pace. I just simply think they hate being in Congress.
Yeah, if you kind of hate government, then why would you spend your life's work doing it, seemingly? I mean, at least I won't say all Republicans do, but some of the more new breed that talks about, you know, their feelings on government, why would they want to stay there? Well, so Kevin McCarthy, you're right, Tim, that if he does resign, he's resigning, when he leaves, the numbers are so low and they just kicked out Santos, and that wouldn't have been a reason to keep him if you had a real moral imperative what they did to get rid of him. But is there any chance you think that seat flips, given that we've seen a lot of these special elections be problematic for Republicans? Catherine first.
It's a pretty tight Republican district, but anything's possible if the Democrats can motivate voters and if the Republicans are, if that whoever they run as the Republican isn't, particularly compelling, anything's possible depending on the candidates, the timing, and just sort of general attitudes in that district.
Yeah, and I don't know the makeup of the district as far as is there a college of any size in it? What's the, in particular, the educational situation? Because that seems to be a big part of the secret to success in these special elections for the Democrats. Tim, we know it's a Republican district, but what are the odds?
I don't know. That's the 20th district up around Bakersfield, that area. There is a college there, Cal State Bakersfield, but I don't think that's in the Central Valley. That's Republican country. I guess anything's possible, David. But if that district flips, there's not a safe Republican district in California next year. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, I don't think in a regular election it would be at any risk. And honestly, if it's a district that's been Republican cycle after cycle after cycle, that probably doesn't make it the same as that district I was comparing it to in South Florida, because that district had voted for Hillary Clinton. It was just in recent years it had trended for Donald Trump. I think Ron DeSantis was the one that won it by like 20-some-odd points, and then it was a very narrow Republican victory in that special election. So it kind of has, I guess, a different profile than this seat. But we're just seeing these trends where, Republicans have such trouble with special elections. Probably, I guess, more pertinent to our conversation would be the Santos district in York. They actually got candidates this past week, and that seems very flippable, correct, Tim?
Yes, absolutely. The former congressman there is going to come back and run Democrat, and it looks prime for the taking. I believe we're going to flip that one. We may flip as many as four districts in New York this cycle.
And that'd be in the regular election. The special election for George Santos' old seat, Catherine, your thoughts on that one?
Oh, I'm sure we'll – I'm pretty confident that we'll get that back.
Yeah. So that would be the progress.
That was a fluke.
Just didn't have
It was that he got elected. It was a fluke. She's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully George Santos, his whole aura will be a fluke among our democracy and not the normal operating procedure. Well, Tim, you've got an outrage for us that actually leads into a much bigger topic that we're going to be discussing really between now and November 2024. Go ahead with that outrage.
Sure. Charles Koch, Ken Langone, Frank Lawkeen, Stanley Druckenmiller. All of these people have a few things in common. First of all, they're all billionaires. They're among some of the richest people in the country. Another thing that they have in common is that they all right now support Nikki Haley in her campaign for the GOP presidential nomination. Finally, and what I'm going to talk about for just a couple of minutes today, They all speak favorably about Ambassador Haley's plans that she's announced for what she refers to as entitlement reform. Well, when most Republicans use the word reform in this context, what they normally mean is cuts, and specifically when they are referring to Social Security and Medicare, which they are now. Now, I'm certain that many of them would both protest and deny what I just said, but history proves me correct. They've never really liked Social Security, along with almost all other social programs. And we know, you know, from history that after Harry Truman first proposed Medicare in 1948, that they spent the next 17 years fighting its very inception tooth and nail until it finally passed in 1965. So that's why every chance they get, they bring that word reform up. And one of their favorite ways to do that is to bring up the national debt. You know, that thing they only mention when there's a Democratic president. Then they give it that, quote, everything needs to be on the table speech about cutting the budget. But taxes are not on the table, naturally, unless they're talking about tax cuts, cuts that always benefit the rich almost exclusively, but sales taxes are great, so there's that. Never mind that those, what sales taxes do to the poor and working people, by the way. And then they almost always deliver their closing argument that Democrats are not being truthful about these programs, they are going broke, and only the Republicans want to protect them. I might add here that they somehow failed to mention that Social Security is fully paid for by the American people and has never cost the government of this country one dime. Now to present circumstances. Nikki Haley, like all Republican presidential candidates not named Trump, is trying to somehow separate herself from the rest of the field in hopes of setting up a one-on-one match with a former president. And this is one of her solutions. She is proposing that younger workers should have their retirement age raised in order to draw full benefits. And no, she wouldn't say what age. And she also proposes that benefits be cut for high-income beneficiaries. And again, no, she didn't mention what income or what the cuts would be. She also didn't bother to mention that the Social Security system was designed to be universal. All must participate. And let me go out on a limb here and guess that if rich people get their benefits cut, then they're going to want to pay less or even nothing into the system, which could cause the system to collapse. Then I'm sure people like Nikki Haley would throw up their hands in despair and proclaim that they told us all along it was going broke, that they were right. Right now, Social Security is in the black until 2034. There's an income cap set this year at $168,600 of income. Income above that amount is not taxed for Social Security. So I'll tell you what, eliminate that cap and the system is solvent until at least 2046. At that point, baby boomers, who make up a large plurality of retirees, will be between the ages of 80 and 99 and dying out. The problem will be solved about the solvency of Social Security. With Medicare, it's about as simple. My first choice would be Medicare for All, something that was made famous by Bernie Sanders. Statistics clearly show that Medicare is more both affordable and effective than private insurance. Another idea proposed by Hillary Clinton is that the power of the federal government be used to negotiate lower prices with drug companies and providers. Either way, the problem is again solved. Right now, of course, these things would not pass Congress. We need Democrats in both houses in sufficient numbers, along with the presidency, of course, to get this done. I do also know this. Nikki Haley would need a lot of Republican wins in these races to enact her plans. We can't let that happen, folks. Over 40% of seniors would drop below the poverty level without Social Security and Medicare. These seniors, unfortunately, largely vote Republican. Now, I won't get into the fact that they're voting to cut their own throats, which they are, but I will mention this. 93% of Republican voters don't think that Social Security benefits need to be cut. 69% of them don't want Medicare benefits cut either, and we know that Democrats and independents oppose these cuts by even wider margins. She had better pay attention to what people out here are saying, because on Election Day, we have all the power to remind her of that. You do that and just watch her and others like her change their tune. Now, I'll leave this with a warning. Elect the wrong party and this power you have will be gone. And those social programs that we love and depend on.
Yes, so much here to kind of unpack. But I'm going to start here, and something we were talking about this during the week I reminded y'all of is, you know, George Bush, he won re-election in 2004, and almost instantly he seemed to be getting a little less popular after that. But the thing that cratered his popularity ratings was when the Republicans and he, you know, pushed starting to privatize at least a portion of Social Security and go down this road. People turned against him, and 2006 was really a banner year for Democrats that led as a precursor to 2008, because 2006, the economy was not that bad at that point. That was simply a lot of the blowback from this idea. Catherine, do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember that. And this is so frustrating for me, this whole discussion about Social Security and Medicare. It's so simple. The solution is right there. Raise the tax, raise the level where people continue to pay taxes. Stop calling it an entitlement program. It's not entitlements. We've paid for it. We've all been paying for it for our whole lives. We're not entitled to it. We earned it. But that's their way of making it sound like it's something that we, you know, it's not required. It's like a, anyway, but yes, I think Nikki Haley is definitely on a narrow, high wire right now talking about this.
Yeah. Well, there's actually two more discussions I want to have off of this, but we may not be able to get into them now and may have to wait till the other side of Alex. But one thing I think we do have time to talk about is we've been wanting to do a buy-sell hold on the the emergence of Nikki Haley as the Donald Trump alternative. If she could make this a one-on-one race with Donald Trump in the Republican primaries, could she defeat him? Now, obviously, I think a lot of Democrats would be like, that's great, because Nikki Haley probably believes in democracy at some level. I don't think she has any designs on becoming a dictator. Her terrible policies on Medicare and Social Security withstanding. But let's talk about just that question. If she became the one-on-one other Republican choice to Donald Trump, would you buy, sell, or hold her prospects, Tim?
Sell totally, for two reasons. Number one, her stance on issues like this and her hard line on abortion, talking about signing a 6 weeks, you know, ban on abortion. And number two, Trump has been hit with everything but the kitchen sink, and he's still holding his vote. He's still holding his lead. I think that thing's over.
Yeah. Catherine, same question.
Yeah, I mean, I just think all these people who continue to run against Donald Trump are spending good money after bad. I mean, there's just no like Tim said, it just we hit him with everything. He's 91 indictments, and he's still the most popular GOP candidate. So, yeah, that game's over.
Yeah, so. I'm going to sell as well. I mean, three for three. And what is so, you know, vexing about this is how many candidates jumped into this race thinking that there was some second or third lane, however you want to phrase it, because in the primary, I guess it would be a second lane, and then in the general, I guess theoretically, if you look at it, it's a third lane, but thought there would be something there. There is apparently nothing there, and all these people have flamed out. They've probably created some toxicity among the hardcore Republican base that they're never going to be viable again. Some of them, this is like Nikki Haley, it was probably her only moment because she'll now have been out of the governor's mansion of South Carolina for upwards of 8 years. She was in the Trump administration. I doubt she gets invited back into this new collection of characters that we may discuss at some point too. So there's just not much there as a prospect for. And then, of course, Tim, I think you're right. If these policy proposals are so unpopular, and that's what's so interesting but weird about the Trump base is you've got a lot of Republicans that do like these ideas of, you know, let's, you know, shrink government so far down and let's get rid of programs like Social Security and Medicare. And they make up a portion of the Republican base and probably a lot of the real thought police of that party. But then the new Republicans that have come into the Trump base, they're the kind of folks, that's not what motivates them. And they probably depend on those two programs once they reach 62, 65, 67, whenever they decide to take Social Security, whenever they can go on Medicare. And it's the way that it's essentially probably most of their retirement, and there's nothing wrong with that, and they depend on it, but they're motivated by other issues. And sadly, one of them may be the color of Nikki Haley's skin. Folks like that, they may be motivated to try to, you know, bring back some version of America that they've, you know, created and idealized from the past. Tim, you were going to interject something.
Yeah. Have you noticed on both Social Security and abortion, the really hard line stuff, Trump has refused to go there. He is already positioning himself for the general election. One of the few times I can say that's a smart thing to do and put it in the same sentence with Donald Trump. But even he, what she's doing is trying to position herself in the GOP nominating process. Trump is already looking beyond that because he can read polls like we do. He don't need to do anything.
Yeah. Now let's try to branch out into another piece of this with this little bit of time we've got, and we'll stay with Donald Trump. We won't go to other figures who made crazy statements in this genre. But Donald Trump, at a campaign appearance, talked about replacing Obamacare. And we've seen recent polls, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act gets more and more popular every year. It was an odd program in that when President Obama passed it and the Democrats passed it, it was almost underwater. But as every year it functions, it just gets more and more popular. People see more and more the need and the stability and what's good about it. And so it's at this point. But now Donald Trump wants to replace it. Catherine, how off-key as far as, you know, politics and polling was Donald Trump's assertion this past week?
Very much so. The Affordable Care Act or Obamacare or whatever you want to call it is partly the – partly its popularity is based on this sort of new employment model, you know, a lot of gig employment, a lot of part-time, multiple part-time jobs that may not offer benefits. So this the Affordable Care Act can step in and provide that medical security that people want so that they can go off and, you know, be more entrepreneurial or, you know, how, I mean, and I think a lot of this comes from COVID. And the other thing is COVID showed us how important healthcare coverage was as well. So, yeah, everybody's off base if they're going after the Affordable Care Act. I think that it is here to stay, and we can only hope that it gets better and becomes more like Medicare for All.
Yes. Well, we'll get more into this discussion in a while, but right now we're excited to join us, come back on the show and join us for the second time from Nevada, Mr. Alex Diaz. Welcome, Alex.
Hello, Dan. Nice to talk to you. I hope you're doing all right.
Yeah.
Oh, we're doing well. Well, Alex, before we get into the discussion, I'm going to let actually Tim and Catherine handle a lot of the Nevada talk, but I did want to mention when I booked you, you were real active on Twitter. Then you went off of Twitter a while, and then you got back on. I'm glad you got back on, but, of course, I'm sad at the circumstances. You told me you'd taken a break, but then you decided to get back on because of the tragic shooting at UNLV, your alma mater. If you just want to tell us kind of anything about that process, and then if you have any, you know, thoughts you want to share about what happened this past week at UNLV, we want to give you space to do that.
Yeah, I went to UNLV. I went there for, you know, for a couple of years. You know, I remember while I was a student at UNLV, I would hear about school shootings happen at other schools. And, you know, it really hits home when it happens right at my university. I've already graduated, but, you know, it's, you know, the community still feels it. It's like, wow, it happened here.
Yeah, and I think Las Vegas, when we talk about these tragic shootings that come along, and some of them are so tragic because of the age of the victims or the circumstances surrounding. But when I think of the one where, you know, the people like to talk about the good guy and the gun and how this could be prevented by more firearms, Las Vegas, the one that happened at that country music concert, comes to mind as just the one that completely obliterates that theory, because there's no way that anybody prevents, really, I don't know if it was the most, but it was one of the most tragic losses of life in sheer numbers that night at that concert, and it was from an area which, you know, you'd have to be like a sniper, a military figure to, you know, be able to locate that guy.
Essentially, from what I remember from the details of October 1st, I was actually still at UNLV when that happened. By the way, it was like in October 2017. I was still at UNLV, and I remember from the details that Paddock was, he decided to enter the casino. He smuggled in some firearms, and he put a bump stock modification that made it fire like an automatic.
Yeah, and just the window he was at in that Mandalay Bay Hotel, overlooking that area. Well, I'm going to pass it over to Tim, who will pass it to Catherine for questions about Nevada politics now. Tim?
Yeah, good evening, Alex. Thank you for being with us again.
Yeah,
so just this week, six Republican alternate electors from 2020 have been indicted in Nevada, including the state Republican Party chair. And against this backdrop, the governor, Joe Lombardo, is a Republican. Is there any hint that he might somehow try to interfere legally in this case?
Very good question. Like the Attorney General has made it clear, like Attorney General Ford, since he was re-elected, that this was something of interest, that he felt that this went against, the Nevada state constitution, that he felt that it went against the law, and he went after these fake electors. Now, whether Joe Lombardo would intervene, I can't really speak for the governor, but, you know, from what I understand from the governor is that is that he tends to be more of a moderate Republican, and as far as I'm concerned, and that I know of, Joe Lombardo hasn't really engaged in electoral denialism, so I think Lombardo would be less inclined to intervene.
Okay.
Because I don't he's running for re-election in a few years, and I don't think he wants that on his record.
Yeah. Looking ahead to next year, as they do in many states, nonpartisan voters are the largest group of voters in Nevada, outnumbering both Democrats and Republicans.
Yes.
How are they leaning for the 2024 election?
That's interesting because, I mean, if we look at the polling, you know, everything seems pretty dismal for Democrats. The support among Democrats is low. Republicans seem pretty energized, and the polling Republicans have a lead among independents. If you look at just like national polling or Nevada polling, it kind of reflects more or less the same thing. But if we look at what happened in 2022, Catherine Cortez Masto made it out to a very difficult election by slightly less than a point. It was like 0.8. And part of that reason why is because Cortez Masto won about 2/3 of nonpartisan voters.
And Sisolak
failed because he did slightly worse among independents. Like, he was winning them, but let's say where Catherine Cortez Masto was hitting that 67 margin, like 67, 68, Sisolak was hitting more like 55, 56. So that's what cost him the election.
Yeah. So what about Hispanic voters? I know that Democrats have had trouble, like in the state of Florida, losing support among Hispanics. And there are some rumblings in a lot of these other states that Hispanic leaders are saying that their vote should not be taken for granted by anyone. So Hispanic voters are such an important bloc in your state. I believe something like 30% of your population is Hispanic. How does that look for Joe Biden?
From the main concern that I've read, you know, among articles, you know, like, you know, regarding the Hispanic community here in Nevada, is just a concern of is that people are really tuned out. Like, they aren't really motivated. Like, they aren't excited about what they perceive in society. So that's what Hispanic leaders are seeing, is just generally low engagement and low motivation.
I want to ask you one question about Mexico. Then I'm going to send it over to Catherine, because Mexico is going to do something that even the United States has not done. They're probably going to elect a female president this year. What has brought that about in Mexico?
What, next year? What is about that about? Well, it's just there's been a lot of societal changes in Mexico, just like how the U.S. has had changes in terms of women's rights. Like, Mexico has seen a change. In the past, like at least since the 1990s, there's been a very big introduction of women into the workforce. Like, before the 90s, women didn't really work. And it was more like a traditional role. Like, they were like homemakers. So post 1990s, women joined the workforce, and, you know, 2000s, we start seeing more political involvement of women. This is just what happened to transpire, that two of the biggest political coalitions in Mexico happened to garner up women.
Wow.
So,
you know,
I
just want to leave you with this, that I'm jealous of Mexico for getting ahead of us in this. I hope to see the day when we elect a female president in this country. And with that, I'm going to send it over to Catherine. Catherine?
Yep.
Hey, thank you. That's a great introduction. Because I don't know very much about Mexican politics, I'll be honest. And as David said in his intro, it's kind of embarrassing. I mean, I know quite a bit about Canadian politics and a little bit about European, but not very much about Mexican. And I'm surprised that about this these two women that are running. What distinguishes them from each other, and what does it look like as far as left, right, conservative, liberal, as far as these two candidates and their likelihood to be elected?
That's a very good question, actually. Like Mexico's like political alignment is a bit different than the U.S. Like, it's like both parties are pretty big tent parties, like in terms of like coalitions. So the Morena Party has people from the center right, all the way to like people that are almost essentially like communists, like on the far left. So we have people who are very center right, think almost Bill Clinton style, all the way to people who like, that call themselves socialists. That's a Morena coalition. And on the PRI, the PAN, and the PRD coalition, you have a right wing, you have a center, and then a center left coalition. So it's just in Mexico the parties tend to be less ideological. But what distinguishes Sheinbaum from Galvez is that Sheinbaum is she aligns her. She's more of a social democrat. She's a really big she's really big on talking about investing into renewable energy. That's her big thing. She wants Mexico to have less dependence on oil and to start manufacturing more solar energy stuff. And also she says she wants to build more rail in Mexico, while Galvez, her position is that she believes that the public sector in Mexico should be privatized. Like, that there's state-run companies in Mexico that should be privatized. So it's people that still believe in, and whether the government has a bigger role in the economy or not. Like, socially, Galvez has come out in favor of LGBTQ rights. As far as I'm aware, Sheinbaum is also pro-LGBTQ. So socially, both parties aren't that different, like right now, like in terms of social stances. Galvez coalition partners might not like, especially the National Action Party might not like her stance on LGBTQ and abortion, because, the National Action Party is a Christian right party, and they lean more social conservative. But that's the deal that they made when they set up that coalition. It would be a more of a moderate coalition.
Well, that's really interesting. What do people think about, like, what are the general issues that the Mexican voters are concerned about? Are they concerned about climate change? Is that one of the reasons that the one candidate is focusing on, limiting dependence on oil, or is that just her thing?
Well, the thing is that part of Sheinbaum's popularity is that she is seen as AMLO's successor of the party, and AMLO currently has like a 65% approval rating, which is pretty high, and that popularity is spilling over onto her. Like, she has said that she wants to do what AMLO has been doing, and essentially what AMLO has been doing that has made him fairly popular is that he's done austerity cuts into, the salaries of government officials. He's saying, oh, they're being paid too much. And he's like, let me create social security for people who worked in the informal sectors of the economy. So let's talk, people who work in, like, agriculture, but they never worked with the big business. And he's like, oh, let's come up with the whole pension system for them. So that's why AMLO is really popular with the Mexican working class. He has given them something, and a lot of people like that. And Sheinbaum has said she's going to roll off what AMLO has done, and so that's why she's maintaining that popularity and about like 20-30 point leads in Mexican polls.
Oh, well, that's great. I like to hear this. I need to spend some time studying Mexican politics because it sounds interesting. Anything we missed about Nevada politics? Is there anything like really interesting that we didn't ask you about?
Nevada politics right now, well, right now a lot of people are starting to gear up and prepare for themselves, you know, for 2024. I already know of people that are like, yes, I am busy right now doing calls to, you know, to prospective donors and, you know, talking to organizations. Yeah, people are really ramping up for that primary next year. More so on the local side because, you know, we also, the municipal politics have been moved. We used to have odd year elections where the municipal politics would be, like, let's say Vegas would elect a mayor in, like, I don't know, like 2019, right? Nevada, you know, the Nevada governor at the time, Sisolak, decided, like, you know what, these elections have way too much low turnout. Let's move it to even years. So, right now that's what I'm starting to see is that a lot of the municipal people that are running locally, they're already starting to prepare themselves for next year, and a lot of them hope to clear that primary because if they can clear that primary with over 50, that means they don't have to run again, like in the general in November.
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting. Well, thank you very much for being with us tonight. I'm going to pass it back to David for any final questions. Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah. Well, Alex, I kind of wanted to ask you about the timeline of the Mexican elections, and I'll tell you why. Like, it seems like weeks ago, maybe even months ago, I heard, you know, that the next president of Mexico will be a woman because the two candidates of the parties have been decided. And I thought, wow, the Mexican election's coming up soon. And they're like, oh, no, that's next year. And so kind of give us the timelines, like how candidates are chosen, this campaign period, when the actual election will be, and kind of frame that out for us.
Well, the way that candidates were chosen, they both major candidates of the two biggest coalition parties, which is Morena and PRI-PRD. Morena's separate from the last three I mentioned. So they both essentially selected their candidates through an intra-party selection. It's not exactly like a primary. Like the way that Marina selected Sheinbaum is that they said we're gonna run polling, you know, from different companies, and whoever in the end has the highest polling, essentially there would be polling companies that would call party members around Mexico asking them for, it's like, hey, who do you support more? So they did theirs through an internal party polling, and that's how they selected Sheinbaum. The way that they selected Galvez, I believe it was a matter of the National Action Party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, and the PRD coming together and saying, it's like, okay, we're going to coalesce against Galvez. I believe that's how Galvez was selected in her selection process. So the primary process in Mexico was a little bit more closed. It isn't like an open primary. I shouldn't say open primary for the U.S., but it isn't open to voting like the U.S., you know, where party members get to vote for them directly. So it's a little bit different in that way. The timeline. We're already past the timeline of both major parties have already selected their candidates. So the Mexican presidential election is held this upcoming June in 2024. So we will know. You know, after the first week of June, who won the presidential election.
And is it always in June? Or does it rotate?
Yeah, it's always in June. June. And the president is inaugurated in December, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. So basically, next year when we're going through the presidential election and everybody's complaining about how long the American political season is, we'll just say it could be worse. We could be in Mexico where they've known their candidates for months now.
Yeah.
almost a year long.
Yeah.
Well, I did want to ask you one more question about Nevada. We didn't mention your U.S. Mm-hmm. Senate race. Jackie Rosen, I guess is your junior senator. She's running for reelection. How is that race shaping up?
Jackie Rosen, a lot of people underrate Jackie Rosen. Like some people, you know, have shown concern towards me. Like, Alex, can Jackie Rosen really pull it off? And, people would be concerned based from what they see on polling, because polling, you know, it shows a fairly tight race between Rosen and Sam Brown. But the thing about Jackie Rosen is that she's a constant overperformer in the city of Henderson. Henderson is like a suburb of Vegas. I know the people in Henderson don't like being affiliated with Vegas, but they are very close to Vegas. So sorry, Hendersonites. But anyways, she's a constant overperformer in Henderson. When she first ran for Congress, she overperformed the baseline Democrat performance in Henderson by just a few points. And at that time, you know, Henderson's a Republican leaning city. It votes Republican, you know, by several points. We're talking about, like, I don't know, anywhere between 6 to 10 points, depending on the election. But she was able to close that margin, and Henderson is a city with a substantial number of votes. And in that city, there's a Jewish community. There's a substantial Jewish community. And that Jewish community in Henderson is a little bit more conservative than in other parts of the country. And the thing about Rosen's background is that she is Jewish, and I believe she was the president of a synagogue, and she has very good ties with that community, and she has built herself as a record of being a moderate, and I think with those things together, you know, it won't be easy to paint, you know, Jackie Rosen as being soft on Israel. So that's one thing that Sam Brown can't attack Jackie Rosen on, because Rosen owns that issue pretty much.
Yeah, and we know that that's an issue right now that seems like it's very complicated. Down the road, it's hard to predict what that issue, the impact of it will be and the different twists. And it'll be different from state to state based on, you know, some demographics. Yeah. Well, that was really interesting information, and we're going to continue to watch Nevada, because it's in that handful of 6 to maybe 8 states that are actually going to be in play, and it has a U.S. Senate race. So I think Nevada is going to be one of the top 4 or 5 states to watch for 2024, like it was in 2020 in a lot of ways, like it was in 2022.
Yeah.
So, Alex, we'll continue to call on you. And obviously, as we get closer to that June election date, you're now our Mexican election expert for the Kudzu Vine.
Oh, that's I'm kind of humbled since I started reading into Mexican elections about like 2 years ago. It's like, I wonder what's going on down south. And, you know, I started learning a lot. My brother-in-law is you know, he's a journalist. He reads a lot about Mexico, and I learned a lot about what I know from him. And I started finding out my own sources too, like online. And you know, that's how I kind of keep up with what's going on down there.
Yeah. Well, and you're also, I guess, not 2 years ahead of us. Well, leave us with one last thing. Tell us if anybody wants to follow you on social media, read your writings anywhere else, just share any of that information.
Yeah, you can follow me on my Twitter at AlexODiazNV. So that is AlexODiazNV. Just, you know, my handle for Twitter. That's also my handle for Threads for anybody who uses Threads. Thank you very much for letting me speak on your channel here. And it's good talking to you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to have you again, Alex.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you very much. You guys have a good night. Yeah,
you as well. Okay. All right, Alex Diaz of Nevada, who also knows more about Mexican politics than the three of us. Definitely before tonight, but we've started our journey of learning more, since it sounds like all three of us our intrigue has peaked. Well, let's continue back on that discussion we were talking about. And Catherine, you had just spoken about Donald Trump and his statement about repealing Obamacare. Tim, I'm going to make a statement, and I'm going to let you say more about it. I believe one of the big reasons that Donald Trump wants to either replace, I guess is actually to use his terminology correctly, replace Obamacare is for some reason anything that has the Obama name on it, he wants to change. As much as he, you know, went after Hillary Clinton in 2016, as much as he's gone after Joe Biden in 2020 and since, I just get the sense that Donald Trump has a white-hot passion for President Obama and the Obama administration and the signature achievement that bears his name for a lot of people. He wants to change that and end that, doesn't he?
Trump hates Obama. it's as simple as it goes back to that national correspondence dinner. Obama ridiculed him with Trump in the audience, and he literally hates Barack Obama personally. This is a personal thing with Trump. If it had somebody else's name on it, I doubt he would be this adamant about getting rid of it. And he is so tainted by this that he doesn't even care about the political fallout. He will do whatever it takes if he becomes president to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. And they came within a vote of doing it once before. Only John McCain saved it. And now he has a very Republican Supreme Court behind him. And, I think he'll go right after it if he's elected president. There's no doubt in my mind that he's going to go right after it. He's going to make it a priority.
Yes, and I tell you, I actually think the impetus for all this predates that correspondence dinner. That correspondence dinner may have been like throwing a 10-gallon gasoline can onto that fire. But I don't know if y'all remember this, but when Osama bin Laden, the announcement was made that he had been assassinated, that troops had found him and they had taken him out, they preempted The Apprentice. They preempted every other show, too. But Donald Trump probably didn't care about those shows. And I think he actually sees that in the front, which is just shows you everything you need to know about Donald Trump. One of the greatest villains in American history that... In world history. That caused this horrible, horrific act on the mainland soil of America. We had gotten this guy. This was one of those moments where, you know, Democrats, Republicans, rural city, you know, any kind of divide comes together and says, you know, this is a good thing. Barack Obama announces it. And Donald Trump's reality show, and I was watching that night, got preempted. And I think he really hated that. And that's what started it. And then it just grew more and more and more with the birtherism and everything else. But let's talk about the politics of this thing. You know, Democrats, when we talk about inflation, we're struggling, there's issues, but we continue to see health care is such a strong issue. That's one issue that the people, the majority of the people still think Democrats do better on health care. How big a gift did Donald Trump hand Joe Biden, who was the vice president when the Affordable Health Care Act was passed, who was in the Senate and shepherded that through? How big a gift was he given, Catherine, by this statement this past week by Donald Trump?
For ordinary voters or, you know, people who might, you know, maybe could vote for Trump if they really – it makes a difference. But for his base, they don't care. They trust him. They think he's, you know, all that in a bag of chips. So whatever he says, it doesn't matter to the base that's going to get him to the ticket.
Well, but if all he had was his base and he hadn't grown that base any, then he's going to lose anyway. But if we believe the current political dynamics, he possibly added some people back, maybe some of the new voters that have come online, maybe supporting him. Because obviously we know, too, he did better with older voters. And not to be grim about it, but Tim brought this up during Social Security discussion, some of those folks are dying off. So there has to be something in play to actually make it an election. If we just run it back again and again, there's no change. Tim, same question. How big a gift was Joe Biden given with this statement?
Well, it can't hurt, but Catherine's right about one thing. It's not going to affect Trump's base at all, and it's not going to affect the other people who are not his hardcore base but are thinking about voting for him. They'll dismiss it with saying, oh, he's just talking. He just talks a lot of stuff off the top of his head that either he's not really thinking of doing or that Congress is not going to let him do, and this is one of those things. So I don't know if it will make as big a ripple as we would hope that it would. Somehow, at the moment, I don't think it would.
I think the way it can make an impact is if Democrats begin to shift the conversation to medical care in a bigger way. And it actually fits in the larger economy question. But right now, I mean, we see the polls. If we're going to talk about prices of crap, which the president, no matter which party, has almost zero impact upon, that's not a winner. You've got to get that conversation changed. People talk about it like, Joe Biden or if Donald Trump was in charge, they'd be like a spot checker at the grocery store deciding the price of eggs and milk and Cokes and, potato chips. And that's just not the case. And so we got to figure out some way to change it to a subject in which it's actually truthful. The president, the Congress has decision-making power on this subject. And this is most definitely one of those, those topics. Well, one last thing, and then we're going to have to move on for the evening, is Montana Republican U.S. Senate candidate. He's one of the two, Matt Rosendale. He's one of the two congressmen for Montana. He mentioned this week that he thought medical care was better off when there was no insurance. You just paid your doctor. They came to your house, and you just paid your doctor for the services rendered, and it was so much cheaper and so much more affordable. Catherine, he said this statement in 2023. Wasn't that a lovely view of medical care back in, say, 1893?
Yeah, I think he's been watching reruns of Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, or something. That was such a boneheaded thing to say. The days of, of that kind of health care were prior to, there's just so much to talk about that. Technology, medical advances, aging, the movement of people. I mean, of course, when I was growing up, everyone in our neighborhood went to the same pediatrician, and we all knew him. And if we had an emergency, we called him at home, and he would meet us at his office. But that was 50 years ago, 60 years ago. Times have changed. Get with it, buddy. We're not going back to private medical care. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, Tim, don't you love it when your doctor, when you, let's say, need an ultrasound or, even if you need a surgery, they just come and sterilize your home and they take care of all there on a house call, right?
Right, sure they do, David. It's almost a totally privatized.
Then you give them a chicken.
Yeah, there we go. Totally privatized health care. I think he's been watching too much Little House on the Prairie. That's what Catherine said, just reminded me of that, where, you know,
yeah.
I brought you a dozen eggs, Doc. Yeah, and he says, yeah, just put it in the storeroom there by the apples that the previous patient brought me. I'm afraid it's not. It's not like that. Now his aides immediately saw his mistake. They're trying to walk it back. They claim he was insurance industry. No, he. And of course they added in, oh, he also wants to protect Social Security and Medicare. Why? Of course he does. It's just a silly thing to say, and it's total nonsense.
Yeah, and I think this fits into this bigger narrative of the evening. Nikki Haley wants to cut Medicare. Donald Trump
yeah.
wants to repeal Obamacare. The leading Senate candidate for the Republicans in Montana and a current congressman thinks that medical care functions like it did 100 years ago in rural areas. It probably honestly didn't function like that in a lot of American cities. And so these people are out of touch on this major issue in which people and governments can actually have an impact upon. How can you trust them? This is the narrative that they've given this past week, and Joe Biden and the Democratic Party needs to run with this thing because it is a political winner, but it's not just like, oh, a shell game. It's actually important. And so I think this is, you know, should be part of a reframing of the election. One more last point on this. This guy is running for U.S. Senate in Montana. Probably the second best pickup opportunity based on the demographics and political leanings of the state in the country after West Virginia. And he made this major gaffe. And this can only
yes.
help John Tester in his reelection
right.
race. And
right.
so that's where if it has no more impact outside of the state, it's still going to have huge impact on the nation as a whole. Well, once again, thanks to Alex Diaz for coming on the show tonight and sharing such great information about Mexico and Nevada. And not next Sunday, but next week on Tuesday, the 19th during the morning, we are so excited to have on the show Kevin Oysenow. And Kevin is the new executive director of the Democratic Party of Georgia. He also is currently residing and has been the executive director of both the Rhode Island and the New Jersey Democrats. But in addition to telling about his, you know, thoughts on the Georgia Democratic Party, he's also willing to tell us about New Jersey politics. And if I'm not mistaken, in the, you know, over 15 years long of having the Kudzu Vine, we have never discussed and had a New Jersey expert on the show. And with that U.S. Senate race in particular, that's going to be a really interesting discussion as well. So we're excited in about 9 days' time getting Kevin on the show. But until then, been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, guys.
Good night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created...